Hello and welcome to the second in the series of podcasts featuring two university registrars talking about higher ed stuff. Dave Hall of the University of Leicester and Paul Greatrix of the University of Nottingham talk through a number of topics this week, including job titles, from registrar to COO to CFO and all points in between, the most enjoyable and least satisfying aspects of being a registrar, and the excitement and challenges of a good crisis. There's also lots of stuff about meetings and minute writing. Leicester City fans will be delighted their team features here, as will family and friends of Richard III. There's also an exciting reference to robots and artificial intelligence, but also a bit of a shout out for the more traditional notice board. Enjoy all the stuff. Hello, we're back with registrars talking about higher education stuff, still a working title. So this involves myself, Paul Greatrix, registrar at the University of Nottingham, and Dave Hall, registrar and chief operating officer at the University of Leicester, talking about higher education stuff. So in the previous edition, we were talking a bit about our careers, well, mainly about Dave's careers, to be honest, because I haven't shared most of my stuff yet, and quite a bit about the University of Warwick, but also how you describe your job as a registrar. And it is quite difficult to do, because it doesn't give a lot away as a title. You at least have the chief operating officer bit, which sounds a bit more sexy.
That's why I introduced it.
Yeah, at your behest, presumably.
It was council members that asked me take it. The chair of council thought that even she was struggling to explain to council members, let alone people outside the university, what I did, and hence that's where the title came in.
Yeah, and there are, to be fair, quite a lot of chief operating officers around now. It's, you know, I mean, I'm not saying you're common as muck, but there are more than there used to be. Yeah. And indeed, an exciting survey I did not that long ago of registrars, etc., and their job titles and what they did, showed that, in fact, quite a lot of people had that title. Very few, myself included, we're simply called registrar these days. So we're a bit of a dying breed, the pure registrar title, mainly because I'm just too unimaginative, I think. I can't come up with anything better. So anyway, go back to the issue of what you actually do, right? You were describing before how you... you know, do spend a lot of time, you know, talking to people, advising them, critiquing them, trying to point them in the right direction, give them a steer. But you've got a really big range of you're a unitary registrar and COO, so you've got a big range of responsibilities under you. What broadly then? What does it cover?
The scope of the role extends from, well, the directors of these offices report to me, which gives you an idea. So, Director of Estates and Facilities Management, the Director of IT Services, although we're now appointing a Chief Digital Officer, they're reporting in, the Chief Marketing Officer, the Librarian, the Finance Director did report in for many years, he now has a dotted line to me and reports direct to the Vice Chancellor, so now as Chief Finance Officer. It's been another change in title over the years. The Academic Registrar, of course, the Director of HR. All those senior staff who run the professional services of the institution. Yeah. So that's my responsibility. And a key part of that role is, how do we work as a team?
Yeah.
How do we stay joined up? How do we work constructively with each other? That we don't push work or blame around the table? Because a fragmented administration increases the risk of service failure to students and staff.
Yeah, and it's the bigger it gets and the more complex it gets, then the harder it is to ensure that you get that join up across. And, you know, people like working in the unit that they think is their home, don't they?
Yeah.
And so people often criticise the silo mentality, but it's understandable that people want a home and they want to feel that they've got colleagues that they can work with. But the primacy of the student as customer in the context of the services that we're often providing, not educational services, but in terms of the kind of wraparound services, is really important, isn't it?
Yeah, I'll give you a real example. The Obviously, we want an estates department which is looking after the teaching and learning spaces and the research spaces, both for students and staff, and keeping them safe and clean and tidy and up to date and optimal and what have you. And there are times when you've got to replace materials and that, and windows, for example, in old buildings. And you want a team that's got a handle on that, taking the windows out, putting the new ones in. What you don't want them to do is for the students to turn up into lecture theatre and discover the windows are all missing because they're scheduled to be replaced in the middle of a
and
time.
And that's the day they're going to do it. Yeah.
And that's a true example. But the potential for that is there all the time. It is a constant responsibility to try and ensure that we stay coordinated and collaborative. And the problem when it gets split up is two challenges. One, it makes the integration more difficult, and probably more painfully, it increases the politicisation, if you like, of the activities around the senior team and that, because you are reinforcing the boundaries around those silos.
Yeah.
And people protect their territory, and it's about power and status and all those sort of things. And you start to lose sight of what you're actually trying to do, which is provide an excellent educational service to students and support the research.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. You talked about the other title issue, which is that other people's titles have been changing over the years. And of course, everyone used to be a bursar, and now they're all CFOs, which again is probably a bit clearer, it has to be said, than bursar. But there's a lot of title inflation in higher education, isn't there? I mean, you know, we talked before about how, you know, you used to have a pretty clear progression route from administrative assistant up to, you know, senior assistant registrar. I'm like, those titles are pretty much gone now, and everyone's a head of something or a director of the other, aren't they?
I suppose I'm kind of ambivalent about it in one sense. You want staff to have a title that gives colleagues an idea about what they do.
Yeah.
And I want staff to be, they're happy in their role and proud, maybe a bit strong, but, you know, feel good about it.
So you want everyone to be a director, Dave?
Well, I think you can...
a chief.
I think you can be happier being called one thing as opposed to another. And I don't normally worry too much about people wanting to call themselves particular things.
Yeah, I think it's a fact of life, anyway. It's one of the things I do get mildly grumpy about from time to time, just because it's more and more difficult to come up with novel titles for
what you shouldn't people. Do is don't call yourself a special projects officer.
No, that way madness lies. Yes, and you know that your time
is your time is up.
Possibly up once you're moving on to special projects.
Yeah.
Just to be clear, though, I mean, for anyone who is, it's a cracking job.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But if you're appointed from outside into the role, it can be a really good foothold, right?
Yeah.
But if you're promoted, in inverted commas, into that role, it's often a signal that something else is afoot. Very good, very, very good point, though. In terms of day-to-day existence, a lot of time is spent in meetings either with individuals or with groups, but and some of those can be immensely satisfying, some of them can be possibly quite tedious. So what do you enjoy most about your job then?
I think there have been particular moments, obviously when the Richard III discovery happened. I mean, that was a pretty special and exciting time when Richard Buckley, the lead archaeologist, he was driving onto campus and he pulled up alongside me and wound his window down, and he just looked out the window and grinned at me because it was going to be confidential, top secret. But the grin said, "We've found the remains of Richard III
in the car park."
In the car park, and that was a fantastic time. It was a lot going on, and the interest and the major interest. I mean, funnily enough, it was fantastic when Leicester won the Premiership, to be fair.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think that kind of thing does make a real difference.
And you felt really part of the city, and we put the football flag up on the flagpole, and they were certainly really good times. I'm not sure that it's easy to say there's something I enjoy about the job, because it's that challenge that I was saying before about seeing an outcome or an output of of what you do. I like, I personally enjoy giving presentations to that staff. I like the banter you can get through that. I like being challenged, you know, can you think on your feet? I have actually enjoyed some of the meetings with the trade unions. It's, you know, it puts you on your mettle. You've got to work hard to find compromises. Yeah. But it's difficult. And there are some very challenging staff and student cases which I've dealt with, which are, I think it sounds a bit pretentious, but intellectually difficult to work your way through. And you know, that's satisfying when you think you've found a path through the governance structure in some way. So that, you know,
I think that's a really good point. I mean, the point about the fact it's very difficult to see concrete outcomes from the work that you do, because often a lot of it is actually being carried forward by other people. And you know, the upside of that is that you've got very capable people who are, you know, driving forward things, and you know, you're helping them do that. The downside is that, you know, everyone else will always get all the credit for these things, and that's just a fact of life. I think, you know, it's just the way it is. But I always think it's slightly paradoxical that, you know, universities are fundamentally long-term activities, right? We're here for, you know, for educating future generations who will go on to do great things, etc. We're here to, you know, to undertake research which will have long-term impact on people and the planet, etc., etc., etc. And yet, in many ways, we are breathtakingly short-termist about everything, you know, and what's happening today and what's happening this week. And, you know, people see everything in a kind of one-year cycle and just struggle to see things in the longer term. And in our role, it seems to me that, you know, part of the job is actually to ensure that some longer term thinking, you know, does actually take place, and that, you know, and I think it's where CFOs as well come into their own as well, is that they're trying to get people onto 5-year time horizons, and planning people as well are always trying to look to a longer term and what's going to happen in terms of student numbers or research or whatever, and think longer term. But actually, we are really short termist,
and I that's no doubt in the main not necessarily due to the quality of university management, but the fact that government policies can throw a long-term strategy off course within the space of a few months.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've worked on capital programmes, and you think you've got a capital programme for 10 years, and you discover a year into it, sometimes into actually constructing something, that it's the wrong size, or it's in the wrong place, or the students aren't going to be there, or the government policies has led to a change in the funding regime, or you've got a problem years ago with SARS and bird flu and those sort of things, and you've got a hit on international student recruitment, which always has a significant impact on the bottom line. So it's rather than setting a clear direction, you are normally tacking across the pond, if you like.
Yeah. No, I think I think that's absolutely right. Absolutely right. But it's one of those things that, for me, makes the job interesting, is having to think, you know, about the longer term consequences of thing, and, you know, try and bring people back to that. But I share your pleasure and engagement with people. It's often things that, you know, are hardest to actually find the time for. But when you're having that, you know, that dialogue and that critical dialogue, particularly with academic colleagues, but also with students as well, about the, you know, the big issues in the university or indeed in the sector, that can be some of the most stimulating and interesting opportunities you get in the university, it seems to me.
That's a very good point, actually. I've got that. I think an important role of any manager is to get to the front line, not just of your own staff, but it is much more productive if I go out and meet, when I go out and meet academic staff and visit departments and that. It is, if you can, engage them in their research.
Yeah.
To talk about that. And often that's fascinating. You know, that's when you might come home at night and say, guess what, today I went to visit Professor X or whatever, and the team are doing this, that, the other.
Yeah.
And blimey, I think we're making a difference.
Yeah.
And suddenly you can start feeling that you're part of something that is having an impact. You know, going and seeing, I went to watch an operation fitting a stent into a heart. Oh, I was expecting to faint, but actually it was fascinating to to watch a heart operation.
Are you a trained anaesthetist then?
I was doing it through there was a glass partition between me and the patient.
Good.
But it's fascinating to do that. I'd forgotten that. Well, actually, the Richard III thing is really an exemplar of it.
Yeah, that Richard III thing was, of course, massively annoying for every other university in the country. But we've obviously since, you know, dug up Robin Hood on the number of occasions in our car park. So you know, these are positives, right? These are good things. What aspects, again, without swearing, of your role do you find least palatable?
Well, I've brought this book in and I've indexed the issues. The thing that is most soul destroying is the politics.
Yeah,
I find it very difficult if we're not all on the same page and operating as a team.
So this is the internal politics within the university.
Yeah, the internal politics. Yeah. That is the thing that wears you down. If you think you haven't, you've got to, well, the effort you've got to make to get colleagues on side not be overly sensitive to. I don't know how you describe it. Those frustrations with power and status and who's listened to and who isn't and who's in favour and who's out. All of that is soul destroying. And when we're operating as a group of friends as well as colleagues, it's certainly easier when you're handling success than when you're dealing with problems. But that's the thing that wears you down. And that's why I often say to, you know, when I'm meetings with the director of estates, you know, I'm not surprised you don't come into the meetings at times because you've got a fantastic, you can see what you've done. You know, you've put up this fantastic building which we can all see and walk around and we can pat you on the back with it. And, you know, you've got to grips with some very tangible and pragmatic problems of doing that. Whereas, you know, I'm in the court of Richard III or something.
I absolutely get the politics bit. One of the most challenging things is when there's a crisis, right? You mentioned crises earlier, but it's often the case that you know, you're the first port of call when things go horribly, horribly wrong. Just because no one knows where to go. or, you know, you're at the end of the line because everyone else has been tried and, you know, they don't know what to do. So, I have to say it's quite often the case that, you know, the crisis can actually be quite stimulating because it's, you know, it is that intellectual challenge again, you know, because it's completely unknown. You don't know what it's going to be. You don't know how it's going to pan out. And that can be quite exciting.
I agree completely. I was going to say it's certainly more on the, should you say you enjoy a crisis? But anyway,
well,
it is a more fulfilling experience because again, it gets a bit more command and control.
Yeah.
So you can start
bossing people around.
I was going to say, being directive and clear about what needs to happen. Yeah. People have looked to you.
Yeah.
They looked to you. Somebody's got to make a decision.
Yeah.
And I'm the first person that security or ever will call. And you know, fires, floods, power outages, lightning strike. Student occupations. There's a lot that needs coordinating. Yeah. But often, obviously, the colleagues in IT and estates always come into their own at those times, and they're the ones that really sort it out. But they do want somebody there who's got he's holding the ring and knows what's going on and keeping everybody else informed as well.
But I think the other part of it is the actual staying calm thing, right? Because it's very easy for people to flap. And if I always think if you're calm, even if you have no idea what the hell's going on, at least if you look calm and are able to present a calm demeanour to your colleagues, then that just helps everyone stay calm and that you'll get to the answer much quicker. But sometimes, you really, you know, don't know what to do.
Yeah, it's
and it
true.
Can
and
be quite challenging.
Got there is the... and that's where you do need the experience of other people.
Yeah.
Call to a fire, out to a fire, and the fire brigade, the officer there, was asking me, you know, what's in the lab? Well, I don't know. Which your lab? Well, in one sense it is, in another sense no, it isn't at all. And you know, when they, then it was the a colleague, the insurance officer, she turned up, and you know, the moment was saved.
Yeah.
Because she knew how to get onto the software, say what was in the lab and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. But, but it is, you don't want them to happen, but when they do arise, you feel confident that you can feel...
So a welcome diversion from other activities. So one of the activities we talked about a wee bit before was the amount of time... How much time do you actually spend in meetings, then, do you think, in a typical week?
In a typical week, I would think about... two-thirds.
Yeah.
I thought. But the point I was going to make is you often, I have one colleague in particular who moans about meetings and committees and what have you. But I recall having a meeting with a whole load of staff. This was at Birmingham, actually. And a very prominent academic colleague of mine stood up and was complaining about never being told anything. You know, we're kept in the dark and, you know, and mushrooms and all this sort of stuff. And we never know what's going on. We're not consulted. You should be consulting us. We're at the front line. We know, you know, what's best for the institution. Fair comment. Okay, so we do, you know, so some beat ourselves up over that for a few minutes. And then the next breath, he says, why are you sending on with these emails? And why am I getting called to all these meetings? I haven't got time for all this sort of thing. Bloody hell, no. Come on. If you want a semi-democratic organisation which engages people and consults and seeks their opinions and then communicates back to them, you have to...
It's a two-way street.
And you have to read emails and you have to... You have a responsibility. And what I would introduce for somebody in the army, if you hadn't read the notice board, it was an offence. So you could never say you didn't know something.
Right, so, and it was always on the notice board.
It was on the notice board, yeah.
So you think we should reintroduce notice boards?
Yeah, we should have notice boards.
And make it a disciplinary offence.
And it's a big queue of people in the morning reading the notice boards. And you say, I feel confident, I've achieved something. We're going to find out what's going on. But people, it's genuine, it's frustrating. I don't mind if someone says, look, you've probably told me and I've ignored it, so can you tell me again? That's fine. Yeah. It's when they get very agitated, they get very self-righteous about not being consulted. You think, well, you have been.
It's certainly a common trait. So in an ideal world, would you spend less than two-thirds of your time in meetings? What do you think that's about right?
Yeah, it's a different... I would think about it... Because people criticise, it's just meetings and committees. Actually, it's the process of decision-making within an organisation which is very complex. You have to take into account a lot of information, a lot of different perspectives. And in order to bring that together, to digest it in a sensible and coherent way, requires a range of colleagues to be brought together to have a debate and a dialogue over things, to get those different perspectives, and then form some plan of action.
Yeah.
So, in the head at the point of a crisis we were just talking about, the first thing you do is you get a meeting together.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you just need to know what everybody knows. Yeah. So I am far more relaxed. If a meeting is of no purpose and I'm in it, I'm able to say I think this meeting is of no purpose.
Yeah.
I don't understand why we're all here.
Yeah.
And if I'm... I'd be more polite than that if I wasn't chairing it. But there are people who... It's up to the chair of a meeting to ensure that something productive comes out of it.
Yeah. One of the things that we want to talk about is the issue of minuting and recording meetings, the kind of committee discipline that, you know, we were brought up with, but does seem to have disappeared. Well, I mean, how do we get that back then? Because it does seem to me that in order for meetings to work effectively, there has to be a degree of rigour about them. Yes, you don't need necessarily to have the full-on way it used to be done, but nevertheless, you've got to have the discipline, and it's got to be consistent. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, it's just, you know, meetings anarchy, isn't it? Which is just anathema to us.
And that's where you can get to, it can be a waste of time, people getting together and talking about things and not adding any value to anything or not coming to some conclusion or decision. I think in terms of how do we get back to where we were, and I don't mean this entirely flippantly, is robots. Because I'm just not sure that we... First of all, there's less resource. You have to have two people servicing every committee.
I think it's
quite expensive. And so unless we were to make it more of a formal part of the training of colleagues. I'm not sure how we get back there unless there's some form of digitalisation that can help. I mean, I could foresee that could be one way of helping us out, but...
That's a pretty controversial view. I mean, people do say that, you know, just go for verbatim recording, just record everything and just, you know, stick it in an archive and that's fine. But, I mean, the typical committee conversation is pretty rambling a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And does depend on, you know, a chair summing it up, but also a secretary able to, you know, to synthesize, digest and produce a sensible note at the end of it.
I wasn't suggesting that it was software might, I was thinking software might be able to
you're thinking of
steal.
Yeah, okay, a super robot, all right.
Yeah.
Artificial intelligence.
That it could distill something out of it.
Yeah, okay. Well, that may well happen. And, of course, you know, the AI will affect, I'm sure, the rest of university life in ways that you and I can only begin to speculate, and no doubt we will at some point. So, well, we'll stop it there. But thank you again, Dave, for talking some higher education stuff about our world in the mysterious planet that is registrars. So, thanks a lot. That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course, and if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until the next time.